Already. So, last week I told you guys a couple of my funniest stories from my time playing in screamo bands, playing punk rock music. Tonight I thought I would introduce you to, I would say, sort of a war that some of you guys maybe did not know is going on, a bit of a war of genres. And I would say it's a bit of a one-sided war. I would say one side knows that this battle is going on. The other side has no idea that this is a thing that's happening. And it's something that I was only introduced to slowly as I got more involved in that same punk rock music scene. The funny thing about it is that I have been on both sides of this at different points in time, so I feel like I've got a really good perspective on it. And it's funny. It's a funny thing to have kind of be on two extremes. So you guys know there's, a million different genres of music these days. It's kind of crazy how many genres of music there are. Kyle recently introduced me to like Brazilian jazz music specifically as like a thing he listens to. I was like, I didn't even know that was a thing. There's just all these kind of crazy genres of music. But these two genres that have always kind of been on like opposite extremes, I feel like, and especially in this world that I grew up in, the two extreme, if you had to get the two polar opposite genres, on the one side, you have like what they call hardcore punk rock music, especially like metal and screamo and a lot of that kind of stuff, the genre that I played in and that I broke my leg playing in and all that kind of stuff. If that's one extreme, there was always this like battle going on in that genre with the other extreme. And the other extreme, whatever, if you ask people, what's the genre that's like the furthest opposite from that? Do you guys have any guesses? What would you say? What's the furthest opposite? Pop? Ballroom? It might be Brazilian jazz. I didn't know. Now, if you ask most punk guys, what's the opposite extreme of punk rock music? It's country. Country music is the thing that they're just like, I'll listen to anything but country. You'll never catch me listening to country music. It's actually kind of, it's a joke I've seen online. People be like, if you ask somebody, hey, like, what's your favorite genre of music? And if they respond, anything but country, then that probably means they're like a metalhead or like a punk rock guy. Like, that's just like code for like the fact that they're punk rock. And it's funny because like I said, I've been on kind of both extremes of this at different points in time. I still remember the very first time I ever heard like screamo punk rock metal music. I was at this music festival that my youth group used to go to called Ichthus. It was literally on a farm in the middle of Kentucky. The nearest city was like an hour and a half away, and we would just go camp out in tents in this farm and listen to all this Christian music, all these different stages, all this kind of stuff. And I was the K-Love kid. That's like all I really listened to. So I was excited to go see all the artists that I had heard on the radio. But there's all kinds of music there, all kinds of other Christian music. And I remember one of my best friends growing up in youth group, his name's Clay. He was really, really trying to get me to listen to more like punk music. And so he encouraged me and he said, hey man, look, there's this band that's playing in this tent. It was like a little stage off to the side, a little smaller tent stage, and he said they're called Norma Jean. They're like a punk screamo band. You should come with me and check it out and see what that experience is like. And I remember I followed with him. I was probably, I don't know, 13 at the time, 12 or 13, something like that. And so I went with him, stood in the back, and I hated it. I thought, this is so dumb. I thought it was awful. I just thought it sounded like noise. And I remember at one point I looked over at him and I was just like, I can't even understand what they're saying. If you can't understand the words, why would you be into this music? Why'd you even listen to that? And I walked away and kind of left Clay there to watch this band that he liked. There's some crazy ironies of that story. One, the obvious one is that I ended up in like a screamo band myself later. And that was what people always used to say. You can't even understand the words, all this kind of stuff. Exactly what I used to say. I totally understood it because I was in that same boat. An even crazier thing. The same buddy Clay, he is now a band member of that band, Norma Jean. I grew up playing music with him, and through a crazy series of connections. Norma Jean ended up needing a new guitarist, and now he tours all over the world, basically, with this band, playing with them. And who would have known, the two of us standing in the back of this venue hearing Norma Jean play, and me complaining about the screamo music, and Clay trying to get me into it. Years later, I would have played in a band like that, and Clay would be in that band. So eventually he did win out. He finally convinced me. I finally started to find some music that I liked. And I do credit Clay, actually. He's the guy that got me into that genre. He didn't give up. He kept trying to show me music that I would like. But as soon as I jumped in, I became kind of the ultimate extreme annoying punk rock guy. And I remember that's who I was in school. Whenever I got to high school, I was the skinny jeans guy that, like, when you would talk to him and be like, what do you listen to? I'd be like, I only listen to screamo music. And I would just like, I used to answer that question, what do you listen to? I'd be like, anything but country. That was always my thing. Because like I said, this is kind of a one-sided war. I don't think that country music knows that all of these like punk rockers out there really hate them or view it as like the opposite of what they like. But I was that guy. I was like, I'll listen to anything but country, never listen to country music. And so it was funny because I was pretty adamant about that, pretty hardcore about it. But it's interesting the things that'll cause you to somewhat compromise on your ideals. It was several years later. I was a student here at Mid-South, and after years of trying to impress girls and never having any girl reciprocate, finally one of the students at Mid-South decided that she would say yes to a date, and I briefly dated a girl that was a student here at the school. And guess what her favorite genre of music was? Country music. And suddenly, I'll listen to country. I'll see what's up with that. I'll like check it out. And she started sending me artists, and I started like checking out some of the music and listening to some of them. And I was like, you know what? This is pretty good. A lot of it. I still am kind of in this place now where there's a lot of country music that I really, really like. And as I've thought back on that, I really do think I'm kind of in this mode now where I'm just listening to all kinds of stuff. I love all of this stuff. And I've just realized how dumb it was to sort of fall on one extreme or the other with any of it, you know. But the reality is, human beings, we always do that. We have a very hard time staying somewhere in the middle of something. We kind of always float to one extreme or the other, whether it's politics, whether it's country music versus metal music, whether it is Marvel versus DC, whether it is whatever thing that you're interested in. People tend to kind of like pick a side, and it's hard to have this like middle ground. It is really hard for people to live in that middle ground. But the reality is that I really think the middle ground is almost always where God is actually calling us to. I think we tend to make this extreme and fall off the edge on either of these extremes. And lots of times it's that tension in the middle where I think we actually find God's vision for us. And so today I want to talk about two extremes that I see in church specifically, two extremes that I see churches swinging one way or the other. And this middle ground that I think is where we want to be. Like I said, this is the third part, the final part of a series where I'm kind of trying to lay out the foundations of what makes Wayfarers what it is. And so far, we've talked about who we're trying to reach. We've talked about the way we're trying to do it. You know, what's our values? How are we trying to do it? And tonight, I'm going to be talking about the very last component of that, which is just some practicality of how we're doing it and what we need to make this reality happen. So I'm going to pray, and we're going to jump right in. Lord, I ask that you would help me to show this middle way between the extremes that I think lays out the way that you want us to follow. I ask that your Spirit would speak through me, open our ears to hear, let it come into our hearts, lead us to obey and follow in your way. become the people that you would want us to be. In Jesus' name, amen. So, the two extremes. The first one is I like to call it the count the cost camp. I've mentioned a little bit that in the first sermon that my dad was a big fan of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, his most famous book is called The Cost of Discipleship. It's the one that I accidentally said that's where the upside down kingdom comes from, and it turns out that wasn't where it comes from at all, but Dietrich Bonhoeffer is like the center of everything that he's about is this idea of the cost of discipleship. And there's a passage he builds his entire beliefs on, and it's Luke chapter 14, specifically verses 25 through 35. It's a verse that I'm sure you guys are familiar with. You have probably heard it before. When I even say the phrase, count the cost, your brain probably immediately goes to this. But I want to read it for you just to give us some context here. And notice this first thing. It starts with large crowds and says in verse 25, large crowds are traveling with Jesus. And turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation, while the other is still a long way off, and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear. In this passage, Jesus is talking about the fact, because again, there's these large crowds of people that are coming to him, and Jesus is saying, like, I don't think some of you have really sat down and calculated it. You haven't done your budget. You haven't counted the cost of what it's going to take to follow me. And this is what Dietrich Bonhoeffer realized about a lot of the people in his culture. He was, again, a pastor in Germany during the time of World War II. And at that time, everyone in Germany, they were pretty much Lutheran just because that's what you were if you were German. You were Lutheran. And he just realized that there were all of these people involved in churches also supporting the Nazi party who had just never sacrificed anything to be a part of the church. They were just in church because that's what you did. And he became very obsessed with this idea of the fact that you have to count the cost of what it takes to follow Jesus. You've got to make some sacrifices. You have to sacrifice everything to be a part of following Jesus. And I think that there's a lot of churches that like to emphasize some of these sorts of teachings. They like to talk about, these are the things you have to do to follow Jesus. You've got to give up these things. They like to preach a lot on the things that you have to give up in your life, the things that you can't do, the things that you won't do. I would say a lot of youth group sermons that I grew up listening to were this kind of way, where it's just the sermons are really more about the fact that you can't drink, you can't have sex before you're married, you can't, it's all these things you can't do. It's just like, hey, I want to make sure you know what you can't do. Like, what are we giving up? What is the cost of going to follow Jesus? I want to make sure we are all on the same page. And if you are not giving up that cost, they guilt trip you for it. It's even simple things like, you know, are you praying? Are you doing Bible study? Are you, doing the things that it costs to follow Jesus? And that's just the entire focus of it. And like I said, this Cost of Discipleship book was really influential to my dad. So I grew up with this message being like top of my mind. I was on that extreme of the spectrum. And so I was always frustrated with people that tried to make the gospel too easy. That tried to make it just like, all you got to do is pray this prayer and you're good. Doesn't matter if you do anything else. My entire life growing up with my dad and Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the back of my mind. I was like this guy that was like, no. You got to count the cost. Following Jesus is hard. I remember one of my favorite stories I used to tell is a story that I took from another megachurch pastor that I had listened to. And he was retelling that story of the woman at the well. Jesus has this experience with the woman at the well. And he talks about living water and the awesomeness of living water. And the woman at the well comes to Jesus and she says, well, what do I got to do to get this living water? And this pastor was saying, as a pastor, that's like the slam dunk. When somebody comes to you, you've given them the whole pitch. You've walked them through all these passages in Romans. And at the end they say, well, I'm in. What do I got to do? What do I got to do to make this happen? That's when you say, pray this prayer, come forward, be baptized, fill out a connection card. We'll get back in touch with you. That's what you do. He's like, you bring them in. They're ready to go. Let's make it happen. But he noticed, and I loved this. I remember I was like, oh, this is awesome. He noticed that that's not what Jesus does. Jesus looks at her. She says, what do I got to do to get this water? Come on, I'm in. You sold me on it. What do I got to do? And Jesus says, go get your husband. Immediately goes at like the center of a difficulty in her life. You know, immediately there's this challenge suddenly. Is she going to be honest with Jesus or not about her situation? And she passes the test. She counts the cost. She is honest with Jesus, says, I don't have a husband. You know, I'm just living with a guy right now. And Jesus says, that's right, you've had five. And the one you're with is not your husband right now. He kind of immediately makes it a little harder for her. And I remember this pastor basically said, I still think this point is true. Jesus did not make it easy to follow him. Over and over and over again, when there are large crowds of people, when people come to him and say, what do I got to do to get this water? What do I got to do this thing? Jesus does not say, it's quick and easy. There's three steps. Fill out this connection card. We'll get in touch with you. That's not how he does it. It's hard. Because he doesn't want, Dietrich Bonhoeffer is right. He doesn't want people that are just sort of committed. And like I said, this was my passion for the longest time. I was the guy that was just making everybody mad and just talking about following Jesus should be hard. You should count the cost. That's the thing you should do. But then I remember there was a second verse that I read that I feel like is from this other extreme. I'm going to call this extreme claiming the treasure. But this verse really rocked my world when I really started to finally pay attention to it. And kind of put it in context of this same idea of counting the cost. This is in Matthew chapter 13, starting in verse 44. And it's a parable that Jesus tells where he's describing what the kingdom of God is like. He's actually told several parables at this point. He's going to give you lots of different images to think about what the kingdom of God is like. And he's going to make sure you got a lot of different metaphors in your head. And this is one of the ones that he talks about. He talks about a treasure. So in verse 44, it says, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. I think I had made the mistake most of my life of going too far to this other extreme of only talking about what you have to sell. What's the cost? What did it cost to get the thing that you need to do? And Jesus it talks about the cost. This passage talks about a guy who sells everything. The cost is everything. That's the thing that Jesus emphasized even in that other passage. The cost is everything. The cost is very high. But what do you get in exchange? In exchange, it is a treasure. It is something of great value. It's something that's worth the cost. I think if you had gone to this man who sold everything he had so he could buy this field and get this treasure that was hidden in there, and if you'd asked him, do you regret it? You know, do you regret selling everything? He'd have been like, no, I don't regret it. Look at this treasure. I sold stuff that's barely worth anything just to get this field, because this treasure is incredible. This is insane. This is amazing. Even this guy who finds a pearl, he's like, this pearl is worth it. This is really something of value. And see, I had spent so much of my life just telling people, you've got to give up everything. It's going to cost you a lot to follow Jesus. But I had spent almost no time talking about why it was worth it. What's the treasure that you get in exchange for giving that up? And I think there are churches that talk about this. Like I said, I specifically use the phrase claim the treasure because I think there's prosperity gospel churches that the big phrase they like to use all the time is name it and claim it. You know, I'm going to name it and claim it. I can receive these amazing things from God if I just name it, if I can claim it. And there's a lot of churches that talk about claiming that treasure. They talk about all of the amazing things that come with following Jesus. And the list is incredible. The more I've read into the scriptures, the more I'm like, man, this list is insane. There's so many things. The treasure really is worth it. But again, it's an extreme. I think people go too far to the extreme. They only talk about claiming the treasure. They don't talk about counting the cost. These prosperity gospel churches tell you all about the amazing things that you can get and not about the fact that there's some things that you're going to have to give up to get it. And so I wanted to walk this line a little bit at Wayfarers. And if I'm being honest, I think I probably have been leaning almost a little bit more towards this treasure side of it than the cost side, because I'm just overcompensating for the fact that the first 30 years of my life were on the count the cost side. But I do think a lot of us who've grown up in churches, we've grown up in those count the cost churches, I would say, more than the name it and claim it churches. You know, in my experience, a lot of us have been in these churches that just like to talk about the things that we're giving up. I always see this phrase that comes up in corporate America a lot, like in just big corporations, big corporate conglomerates. Lots of times they will talk about doing things for the shareholders. You know, like they have tons of stocks, people own stocks in their company. And when they're like, why are we doing this? Well, we're doing it for the shareholders. Think of the shareholders. And I've seen a lot of people making fun of that lately. You know, they like when they if you work for one of these big companies, and I see people all the time, they're like, so my soul crushing cubicle job was awful this day, but at least I brought some value to the shareholders. That's the thing that gives me life. At least I'm doing it for the shareholders. That's the thing that gets them excited, and they're just kind of sarcastically talking about that doesn't motivate anybody. But I think most churches, they could replace the shareholders and maybe just put the lost. And so anytime you start to complain about like, listen, this is kind of hard. I'm having to give up a lot to do this. I can't do a lot of the things that I want to be doing or need to be doing. Like, don't you care about the lost? You know, at the end of the day, you're doing this for the lost. You're doing this for the lost people, you know, and they want to talk about the cost it takes and all the things that you need to do and how you need to sign up to volunteer and how everybody needs to be serving and how everybody needs to be working. And anytime you try to complain about it, there's just a guilt trip for like, you should do it for the shareholders, do it for the lost. But the reality is, I just think we haven't talked about the treasure. And that's why so much of what I've been doing over the last few years at Wayfarers has been trying to talk about the treasure. There's a million different ways I could do it, but a quick way I'll explain it. It'll kind of help you see why we do things the way we do it here at Wayfarers. One example of that. I do think that there's a lot of churches out there that the structure is such that to participate in it means you are going to get burnt out. It's not a matter of if you are going to burn out. It is a matter of when you're going to burn out. I have talked to so many friends who were very committed to their churches. They had counted the cost and they were willing to pay the cost. And they were part of the church leadership training program, and they were part of the greeter team, and they were there every time there was a worship night, and they were there every Wednesday service, and they volunteered for the youth service, and they volunteered to take care of the kids, and they would volunteer to hand out bulletins, and they were there every time the church needed them to be there. And they were like, well, it's worth it, right? We're doing this for the lost. But all of them, every single one of them that I talked to, have eventually gotten to a point to where they can't do it anymore. They're just burnt out. And they leave feeling guilty because they feel like they've let down all of the lost people out there because they got overworked and overstretched. I remember one of my professors here at Mid-South telling me a story that it was the first time I realized that that's what churches are doing. We're burning people out. And he talked about how a lot of churches maybe try to do a big thing that a lot of churches like to do, homeless ministry, helping the homeless, maybe going to a soup kitchen somewhere. That's a good thing to do, right? We should all be doing that. And he told us a story of saying, imagine that there is a woman who is a nurse. And let's say she especially works the night shift at the hospital that she works at. And let's say that one Saturday, she worked all the way through the night shift and decides that next morning she gets off work sometime around 8 or 9 a.m. Instead of going home and going to sleep, she's going to go to church because might as well just stay up, go through it, and she'll just sleep when she's done with church. But let's say she shows up at this church, and this is the Sunday after the church had just done a homeless outreach where they all went to the soup kitchen and volunteered. But they didn't get a good turnout. There weren't a lot of people that came to help at this soup kitchen outreach. And so the pastor gets up there, and what he does that Sunday is he preaches this passage about counting the cost. And he says, some of you aren't willing to sacrifice anything. Some of you aren't willing to sacrifice to even come serve the homeless at this soup kitchen. You're not willing to put in the sacrifice. You guys are lazy. You guys aren't wanting to do it. And he just lays into them, makes them feel guilty for not sacrificing enough for the church. He says, imagine how this nurse feels. She just sacrificed everything. She worked a night shift. She worked 14 hours straight and decided to still come. And all she gets to do is just sit here and hear a guilt trip sermon about how she hasn't sacrificed enough. My professor said, imagine if the pastor switched his mentality to, instead of adding on more events for this nurse to come to, helped her realize how her job as a nurse is sacrificing for the good of other people. What could be a better ministry than being in the healing ministry, healing people? What nurse do you know that does not sacrifice for their patients? That is a real sacrifice. And imagine if he flipped it and got her to realize that the work she is doing as a nurse, that is the sacrifice that Jesus called her to. That is the giving up everything for the sake of other people. The reality is, a lot of us Christians, we are sacrificing things to be Christians. And unfortunately, I think as churches, we realize that a few songs and a sermon on Sunday isn't enough to really form you as a Christian. And so instead, what we do is we just add more things on throughout the week for you to come to help kind of round out this full ministry of what it takes to follow Jesus. And I think that's what most churches have done. They started with their few songs and their sermons. Everyone comes to the few songs and the sermons. You read the Bible and you're like, well, that's not enough to be a Christian. You got to be serving people. You got to be worshiping. You've got to be doing fellowship with other people. And so they're like, okay, we can do that. So we'll do a service day every Thursday. Okay, well, we can do that too. We can do a Wednesday night, like deeper Bible teaching that will do that. Oh, and you know, fellowship's important too. So we'll have a fellowship meal also on Tuesday night. And before long, you know, the only way to actually be involved in that church is to be there like every night of the week. Just go to everything and you get burnt out. That's what happens. That's what happens with a lot of these people. And this story that my professor told was what planted the seeds of what eventually became the way we do it, where we try to keep a lot of it to the Sunday service specifically and just do all of the different things that I think are necessary for being a Christian, but do it on Sundays to give people some of that margin that they need to be able to continue to be the Christians they need to be throughout the week and to be able to not burn out. I really think that part of the treasure of following Jesus, look at the way Jesus describes following him. He says, "My burden is easy, my yoke is light. Come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest." Very few of our churches feel like rest. And I want our space to feel that way. I mentioned it last week, kind of a sanctuary, a rest, a respite. Not one more thing that you need to feel guilty about, but something that is a real treasure that you want to be involved in. And so that's why we scaled it back and we're like, what if we just cycle through everything we need to do on Sundays so that you're committing to one day a week instead of seven? And you can have this space be something that really helps you to claim that treasure, what it means to follow Jesus. And so, like I said, I've been kind of on this extreme of just, that's been my goal, is just to like, I want people to want to come to church. I want it to feel like you've gained a treasure that's worth the sacrifice. And if you don't feel that way, then I don't think we are really putting the true good news treasure of the gospel on display like it needs to be. And that's this dream that I've had, you know, when I've been talking about this whole series called Living the Dream. But there's one thing I've noticed, which is that dream is something that needs to be done with other people. You can't succeed with it on your own. And so if I had to add another word to that tagline, I would say what I want for Wayfarers is I want us to be living the dream together. There's a reality to this dream that it needs multiple people involved. In a lot of ways, I feel like I have, up until this point, sort of made the same mistake a lot of other churches make, of thinking all it takes is like the leaders being on board with that idea, and me as the leader, I can like force this space to be the dreamlike space that we want it to be. But like I said, I think I've been leaning a little too far to this extreme of the treasure, and I haven't talked enough about there's some sacrifices that need to be made, some costs that need to be made. We need all of us in this together if this dream is going to actually be made a reality. And so there's three things that I want to talk about. These are the three things I think we need to make this dream a reality. The three things that I'm looking for members of Wayfarers to contribute. Obviously, there's all kinds of things that we could be doing. I want to be doing all of those things together. But very simply, rather than like 7 days a week of commitment and all these other kinds of things, there's just three specific things that I think are sacrifices, but that I think are costs that are worth it for accomplishing that dream together. And the first one is the one that every church talks about all the time, the one I've purposely avoided talking about because it's so difficult and so messy, which is that we need help financially. I've avoided talking about this specifically because when I worked at Avenue Coffee, there was a conversation I once had with a guy who was basically just talking about how much he hated that he can't seem to go to any church without them asking for money. It's like, why is it that every single church I go to always asks for money? And that was the reason he had like avoided going to any church that he had been to, because he's like, show me a church that doesn't ask for money and I will go there. And I remember I've had this guy's face in mind from the time we started Wayfarers, and it's like this reason I didn't want like an offering time during our service, and the reason I don't always make this big push to help financially. But I was challenged on this recently as I was going through the process of getting ready for, of going through the Nexus process to be a part of the Nexus church planting organization. And they really pushed me on it because they were saying, we totally get that. That totally makes sense. And, you know, they were totally fine with, I'm kind of still like, the way churches talk about tithes and some of that stuff, I still don't really think that that's like good Bible exegesis. So I was like, I don't know that I'm going to be sitting here telling people to tithe because you'll get blessed by God and all this other kind of stuff. And they were like, yeah, we understand that. We totally feel that. But the big thing that they challenged me with was that they were going to go to a whole bunch of other churches around the country. That's what Nexus does. They get money for church plants. And so they're like, we're going to be going to a lot of other churches around the country, asking them to give money, a lot of individuals, so that your church plant can get up off the ground. And those people are going to have to make sacrifices to make that happen. And it's going to be hard for them to want to sacrifice, financially especially, if I ask, well, how many of the people in that are a part of it have sacrificed financially? And I'm like, well, I don't, like one or two of them give every once in a while. And be like, well, why would I sacrifice if you guys aren't willing to sacrifice? It's not about the 10% necessarily. It's more just about the like heart posture that you're in. Personally, me and Adrian, to be fully transparent with you guys, we weren't giving either. You know, like in my mind, I was like, oh, I'm sacrificing by like working for free for the church. Why would I have to give financially? And so like whenever Nexus was talking to me, they were like, are you giving at least? And I was like, no. And they're like, yeah, why would I go ask these other churches to give if you're not doing anything either? And I remember they really pushed me for it. And I had to sit there and think about it and pray about it. And I realized, I was reminded of this fact that of all the topics in the Bible that Jesus talks about, the number one topic, the one he talks about the most, is money. He talks about money more than any other topic. And I think it's because have you noticed? He uses these financial terms to talk about what it like to follow Jesus. Have you counted the cost? The cost. And when he talks about what you're going to get, he says you're getting a treasure. He's using financial terms to describe the kingdom. And I think it's because it's this universal thing that we all experience. Money is so close. It's a spiritual thing. One of my professors at Mid-South always used to mention that there's different Greek words for money. There's lots of different Greek words you could use. And my professor used to say the one that Jesus uses the most is mammon, which is a particular Greek word that has like spiritual connotations. It's the word for like the Greek god of money. It's a god for a lot of people. It's an idol. It's something that's spiritual in a lot of ways. And so the main thing Nexus was saying is they're like, we're not pushing you to say everybody's tithing and everybody's giving or anything like that. You can look at the woman who gives that one coin, and Jesus says, that's the sacrifice I want to see. It's not about the amount. We just want to see something. We want to see that you guys are sold on it as the leadership and as everybody else. And one of the best ways you can show that, one of the best ways you can spiritually connect with that is financially. And they convinced me. And so Adrian and I talked and we decided, yeah, no, we are going to start doing about 10% of our income. We went up and set it up automatically so that it just comes into what the church is doing. And again, I'm not a prosperity gospel guy, but I can't share this story without telling you guys. A couple days after Adrian and I made that decision, I was informed that I was getting a Christmas bonus here at Mid-South, which Mid-South has never given out Christmas bonuses. Like, I've been working here for years. My dad's been working here for years. We never give out Christmas bonuses. And it was a large Christmas bonus. It was a really large amount. It was a huge percentage of my yearly income as a Christmas bonus. And I just took that as a sign from the Lord that, you know, my heart's in the right place. I've made this decision to sacrifice. And he was like, I'll provide for you. Don't worry. I will help you financially. He just wants to see where your heart is, that you are willing to sacrifice to make it happen. And so I've hesitated saying that, but I really do believe it. If we are going to make this happen together, we all need to sacrifice. And in one of those first areas, we can help. We need help financially. And you guys can help be a part of that. The second thing we need is we just need you to come be a part of what we're doing, to come on Sundays. The average church attendance in the U.S. right now is 2 Sundays out of a month. So if somebody like goes regularly to church on Sunday, if they go regularly, that means they go 2 Sundays a month. Two out of Sundays a month is like, yeah, you're doing great. You're coming like super regularly if you're coming 2 Sundays a month. And that's the average across the whole country. But the reality is that for this experiment to work like it needs to, we need to be here more than that. Because like I said, we're doing different things every Sunday. So if you're only coming here and there, you're only getting parts of it. You might get the sermon or you might get the fellowship, but you're missing out on the whole package. And again, I'm not asking you guys to come 6 days a week or 3 days a week or, you know, there's just Sundays. It's one day out of the week for a few hours. And you can come and you can get the kind of to come regularly, you'll get the full experience. And again, this is another one of those things that I've hesitated to say. You got to be here every Sunday, because it's another guilt trippy thing that so many pastors try to do. They're always trying to guilt trip you about not coming on Sundays. And I wanted to give people the freedom. Look, I know life happens, things happen. You could, you know, miss Sundays. It's not like a spiritual, like moral thing for me if you're missing Sundays, but I do think you're missing out. I think you're missing out on the full experience, the full treasure that you can get if you're here every Sunday. But I also think, and this is the thing that a friend of mine told me about his church, he noticed a real difference in his church once they hit a certain number of people that were coming regularly. And that difference was that if a new person came in, there was almost always someone else in the room that he could go get that person connected to. You know, he could be like, oh, you have kids? You should go meet this family. They have kids. Oh, you're really into like fantasy books? You should go talk to this guy. He's really into fantasy books. It's like, oh, you're really, you know, maybe you work in accounting. Here's another person that works in accounting. There's just a certain reality of like, you just need a certain critical mass of people to be able to have those connections happening and to have the vibrancy of what it feels like to be a part of a Christian community. And, a difficult part sometimes that we've had is that when we have new people come in and, you know, visitors come in, almost always they'll talk to me and I'll be like, oh, so-and-so would be a great person for me to get you connected with. And it's always so hard. And they're like, but they're not here right now. They might be here next week. You should come next week and I could get you connected with them then. If we all come and are coming regularly, then when those new people come in, it's really easy to get them plugged in, really easy to get connected, really easy to have that community come together. And the last thing we need is just, it's just an overall tone. We need to welcome people. There's a guy that I follow on Twitter, Eric Hokey. His last name is Hokey. It's a weird name, but he was a pastor in New York City for 15 years. He planted a church in New York City. And he was there as the pastor for 15 years. And here recently, he stepped down from that position to start pursuing some other things, had somebody take over his church. And he's just kind of been like making blog posts and kind of tweeting about his experience of leaving full-time ministry. He's now going to work a secular job. And he moved to a different city. He's not in New York City anymore. And he's just kind of talking about his whole transition out of ministry. And he said a really, he told a really sad story of the fact that this is the first time in his life where he's not the pastor, he's just visiting churches. You know, it's the first time he's gotten to a place where he's visiting churches. And he said that he and his wife and his kids visited, the number of the Sigma has some like 15 churches in their, around their area of their, where their new house is, before they had anyone say hi to them at that church service. Like, not talking about a long conversation, not talking about trying to get them connected to anything, but just like notice that they were there and be like, hey, I'm so-and-so, who are you? He said the idea of just like introducing yourself, shaking a hand, welcoming them into the space, he wasn't experiencing. It was like 15 churches before he got to one where somebody turned around and said, "Hey, I'm so and so." He's like, they hated that church. They're not even going to go there anymore. But, you know, he's like, they at least had one thing going for them, which is that they said hi to us. I don't want us to miss out on how huge that can be. There's so many things we can do as a church that can help people feel welcome, that can make things feel welcoming, that can make people want to be a part of what we're doing. But I don't want to overlook a simple thing, as simple as just going over, shaking somebody's hand, saying, "Hey, I'm so-and-so. I'm glad that you're here." That welcoming tone is the thing that I think ultimately can just really help bring people together. Because, like, I can do that. That's, you know, something that's relatively easy for me. But people can tell. They're like, "You're the pastor. You're supposed to do that. You're supposed to come up to me and say, 'Hey, what's up? How's it going? I'm glad that you're here.'" It means so much more for somebody else to do that, to really welcome people in. And so I think if we can start doing these things, these three things, just simple things, I think that we can really start to see some of the dividends of what it will take to make this dream a reality. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the good news, how good the news really is of following you, of the kingdom that you promise us. I ask, Lord, that you would just help to make that dream a reality here in our midst. I know that we want it to be a reality. We are trying. We have ideas. We want to make it happen. But what we really need, Lord, is we need your Spirit. We need your power to make it a reality. I ask, Lord, that you would be a part of this church and a part of what we're doing, that you would make this dream a reality in our midst. In Jesus' name, amen. So we're going to end with time of communion, where we're going to sing this song called "Restoring Eden." Joey introduced me to this song a couple years ago at this point, and I just really connected with it because it really lays out the beauty of the treasure that God has in store for us, this sort of paradise, this Eden-like reality that he wants us to be living in. It's going to take some sacrifice, and this song talks about that. It talks about, "I'm done with compromise. I want what you design. There's nothing like this life following you, Jesus." And I think that that's what I want. I want to see that reality be present here in our midst. So as we sing this song, you can step over to the communion table over here on the side. You can take the communion elements. And I want you to just meditate on, sort of imagine. I think the power of imagination is something that we just think so much about. Imagination. It's the thing that we can't overemphasize. Imagine, what would this church look like if that life that God wants for us was a reality? What would it look like if we could answer people that we are really feel like we're living the dream, not sarcastically, but we're living the dream that God has for us? So, as you take the communion elements, thank the Lord for the sacrifice that he made to make this dream a reality, and how awesome it is that that's what he wants for us. He's a good father who wants that really good gift for us.